Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Board of Public Works. Today, our nation recognizes Juneteenth to commemorate the end of slavery in the United States, which was achieved through the courage and sacrifice of a lot of men and women like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman right here in Maryland. And as you know, I've been pushing the U.S. Treasury Secretary and the administration to reconsider their reversal of the decision and the delay of the release of the Harriet Tubman $20 bill by nearly a decade. Harriet Tubman is a Maryland and an American hero who has more than earned this tribute. I also just want to take a moment to remember the 104th Speaker of the Maryland House of Delegates. He was a good friend of mine, Speaker Clay Mitchell, who passed away last week. You may have noticed the flags lowered on the State House and in all of our state buildings, which we did in his honor, and I'll be speaking at his memorial service on Friday. I just would say that Speaker Mitchell was a man for whom I had a tremendous amount of respect and admiration. I would say he dedicated his life to serving others, and he will always be remembered as an icon and someone who contributed greatly to the state. He certainly was somebody that represented the Eastern Shore and the rest of the state, and I want to extend my heartfelt prayers and my deepest sympathies to the Mitchell family and to everyone who loved him. With that, I will turn the floor over to my colleagues for any opening remarks. Madam Treasurer.
Thank you. I was also going to note the passing of Clay Mitchell, with whom the comptroller and I worked for a number of years on Appropriations Committee. When I first came in 1974, Clay was my subcommittee chair, and we worked closely together. I became his vice chair. When he became chairman, I was the chairman of the subcommittee. When he became speaker, when he was speaker, I was speaker pro tem with Clay. We didn't always agree on things, and at one point, with the support of the comptroller, Delegate Francho, and others, I did run against Clay for Speaker of the House. I didn't win. But after tempers went down, within 2 weeks, Clay was reaching out. We had lunch. We went over what our differences were. He asked me if I would chair the Spending Affordability Committee. And really went out of his way in an unusual to an unusual extent, particularly in those days, for somebody to reach out to someone who had run against him, who had been his friend and seemed to, for a while, have severe disagreements, but recognized that we all were dedicated to public service and to representing our constituents as we thought best, dedicated to what was very good in those days, and I believe still is, compromise and working together. And to me, that was the epitome of Clay as a person dedicated to public service, standing his ground, and then reaching out. And that model is one that we should all recall. I just went down to the House chamber before I came up here, and, you know, Clay is up there on the wall looking just as he did then and just as he does in our minds and in our memories and in our hearts. And I really thank you for your support, and the comptroller has been very, very supportive of Clay in the last several years, as well as before. but I think it's very interesting that it represented a time when we could all work together well.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think he was a good role model. I mean, the point you just made even though he was very passionate, and you guys, I'm sure, clashed and disagreed, he really did set an example on how to find a way to bring people together, even if they didn't always agree. And that's what I like about him. And that's a role model of a father.
Well, I really appreciate the comments, Governor, and I think they're entirely appropriate. And Madam Treasurer, absolutely. I'm delighted to hear that he reached out to you, because I don't remember him reaching out to me. But that's okay. All is forgiven. And I have a wonderful photo of him swearing me in with my family back in 1987 when I started in the legislature with Delegate Dembro, who is sitting before me. And famously, I think I've recounted this before, but I remember after Nancy's failed insurgency, the Speaker's lieutenants were meeting with us and reading out a long list of punishments for our, whatever it was, heresy, I guess. And I put my hand up and said, "That isn't fair." And the response back was, "Well, when you have the votes, get back to us." Yeah. It was a delight, actually, to...
We had them for a little while.
Yes. It was a short but brilliant career we had back in the day. And Chair of the Pension Committee, but Treasurer, thank you for everything you represented in the legislature. I always hold you up as an example of people who are in politics for the right reason. And you personally are an embodiment of that. I will happen to say that I did reach out to Clay many times as comptroller, and he's been an absolute champion over on the shore for the values of the Eastern Shore. As the governor and the treasurer said, he was a consummate gentleman. I'll miss him dearly. I counted on him on my many trips over to the Eastern Shore. I'm comforted, frankly, that he's now with Teal, his beloved wife, and I salute his family. Yeah, I just want to say hats off to Speaker Mitchell, and anything I can do to promote his legacy. The governor very nicely named a bridge after him. Yep. That was a terrific event. Yeah. And thank you for doing that.
And a very good symbol, too.
And a very good symbol.
You know, everybody remembers William Donald Schaefer and his Reach the Beach program, but Speaker Mitchell also had a lot to do with that, and widening some of those bridges and raising them up so you wouldn't have to stop for the drawbridges every time on the way to the shore. And a lot of those bridges in Cambridge and Vienna, and the one that we last year named in his honor in Kent Narrow. So we're happy to be able to get the chance to honor him before he passed.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for lowering the flags for him. I also, on Monday of this week, spoke at the Maryland State Firemen's Association Convention in Ocean City. Recently visited with the Sea Pleasant Volunteer Fire Department and Dundalk Fire Station, which was all volunteers. Calling the volunteer men and women who serve in the fire service unsung heroes doesn't even begin to capture the role that 70% of our firefighters in Maryland are volunteers. They're not career firefighters. They have other jobs. They get woken up in the middle of the night and go out in freezing weather to fight fires to protect their communities. It's an astonishing civic philanthropy, I call it, I guess, and it's perfectly representative of the values of volunteer firemen and firewomen all across the state. They happen to be heavily involved in Little League, in coaching soccer and coaching football, and leaders in their church. They give back 100 times over to the community. And once again, I emphasize, they don't get paid. And families, generations of families, serve in the volunteer stations, sons and grandsons and daughters and granddaughters. So they don't, obviously don't do it for money. They do it out of a sense of professionalism, since they're highly trained. and most of all, a love for their community. And that their sincerity comes through. I was presented with a real helmet of a fire, one of the volunteers at the, yes, it didn't really. I have kind of a swelled head, I think, but it was remarkably protective.
I'm going to let that comment just go.
But I told them all that, you know, the hat is just an unbelievable honor, and I'm delighted to have it, and I will put it in my office. Maybe I'll wear it during the next legislative session. But, Governor, if you ever have, you have one of the finest battle axes I've ever seen in my life in your office somewhere back there. And that is a self-defense weapon. If you could possibly maybe put a word in for me with the powers to be in the Firemen's Association, I'm happy to pay for it. But I would love to have one of those in my office, just so I could
it's a giant, you know, ceremonial axe, and it's very intimidating when you come in for a meeting. It's just really a firefighter's honor to be with it. I just like to have it in there for effect.
I know you do. Thank you.
It had
much.
An impact on the comptroller, obviously. But
Governor, could I say one more thing? You mentioned Juneteenth, and I should have reported to you earlier, actually, so I'm doing it now here. The Hall of Records Commission met 2 weeks ago, and we asked for an update on the Harriet Tubman Frederick Douglass statues were downstairs, and they assured us that everything was on schedule, that they would be up January of this coming year.
That's going to be great. Looking forward to that. You can do that during the session. Before we get started with the Secretary's agenda, I just want to welcome for 4 years we had a guy here named Mark Nugent, who I see sitting in the audience, that was the governor's staff person in charge of the Board of Public Works. He's now, I think, unemployed. He actually has moved on to do procurement for MDOT, and Valerie Brodomsky, who used to be with the comptroller and then became the school accountability officer, is now going to be our officer here at BPW. So I want to welcome Valerie. And with that, we start with the Secretary's agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 23 items on the Secretary's agenda. We have 4 reports of emergency procurement. We're ready for any of your questions. We did receive the late request to speak on one of the items.
Yeah, I'd like to start with item number 7.
Okay, item 7 is the public safety secretary. Is here? Yeah, Mr. Secretary Green, come up. And that is the item that we have. Somebody who wants to speak, so the secretary can explain the item, and then we'll call Mr. Cross up. Mr. Bazanson's here as well.
First of all, I'd like to welcome, I think perhaps, to his first official DPW meeting as secretary, our new secretary of the Department of Public Safety and Corrections, Secretary Rob Green. So we'll give him a round of applause. You know, I just, I don't really have questions about this. I just wanted to highlight the item, and then I think we have someone that wants to come speak about it. We'll let you guys touch on this. But we heard approve a contract on the demolition of the Baltimore City Correctional Complex. This is to remove the buildings which have been sitting vacant since we closed the Baltimore City Detention Center in 2015, which I think was universally applauded. We finally brought an end to the long history of deplorable conditions at that facility. And the demolition of these buildings is going to make room for a therapeutic detention center where we can provide opioid addiction treatment and mental health treatment. And I just want to say that we're very excited to have the item before us, and want to thank you. And David Bazanson, I want to thank you for your. I know you've worked on this for a couple of years. We want to thank you for your leadership With that, I'll turn it over to you, Mr. Secretary.
Yes, sir. Governor, you've explained the project very well. We seek approval for the demolition of multiple structures, multiple buildings at the Baltimore City Complex, as you noted, to make room for a much-needed therapeutic treatment center. We've worked collaboratively with the Maryland Historic Trust in this undertaking. We have developed that work resulted in a memorandum of agreement and how the work would be undertaken. The project has been reviewed by the Department of Planning Clearinghouse and has been recommended to proceed as well. So we seek approval so we can move forward with this project expeditiously.
Very good. Anybody have any questions while they're up here that I know? I think we have someone signed up.
I do. I know you've reached a memorandum of agreement, and I know you are preserving some of the most historic buildings, as I understand it. I don't know much about it, to be candid. But I do know that there is a history of a couple centuries in that complex going back to at least 1811. What are you doing, in fact, to make sure that we don't waste this opportunity to discover more about our own history?
I'll let our topic matter expert, Assistant Secretary Bizanson, speak to the work of the House.
Madam Treasurer, in our agreement with Maryland Historic Trust, we have agreed to document all of the structures that are affected by removing historic structures in accordance with federal and state regulation of documenting and preserving for history those records of those structures, much like the archival history when we removed structures at the Maryland House of Correction. And in 1995, we removed the south wing of the Maryland Penitentiary and preserved records for that. There are some buildings on the site that date back to the mid-1800s, namely the Baltimore City Detention Center main building. However, the Historical Trust had indicated that architecturally, before the state owned that property, the modifications to the building removed so much of the historic documentation of that building that it really wasn't a building of interest. There were four buildings of interest and a fifth building known as the Castle, the administration and warden's house of the old city jail. We're preserving that this time until we develop the plan for the therapeutic treatment center. So through a series of record keeping and making documentations with preservation experts, the Board of Public Works approved on May 22nd an agreement with our architectural firm to perform all that record before these are sequenced for demolition.
During the process, is there going to be any effort to use the opportunity? I mean, you're digging up space in historical space. Any effort to use that as an opportunity for learning more? I'm thinking not necessarily just of the structures, but of the complex of the campus.
There's a great deal of documentation on the Maryland Penitentiary. There was a book written by a former correctional officer called A Monument to Good Intentions, which documents the entire history of that penitentiary building.
Yeah, maybe we could follow this up afterwards.
Yes.
I mean, the agreements have been signed. I'm not for unsigning them, and I support this strongly. I think there is an opportunity beyond just looking at the buildings.
We will work with whatever groups or interests as we go through this.
Maybe you could agree to follow up with the treasurer address
any
concerns or ideas.
Thank you. It's a great move.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Any other? So we have somebody signed up.
Mr. Cross is coming in right now.
Mr. Kelly Cross.
Yeah, I believe he was held out because of the crowd, but that he is making his way in. Mr. Cross, I want to come up to the stand. Unfortunately, I don't know if he heard the presentation, then I thought he was in the room. Mr. Cross, just come up to the stand here and introduce yourself to the board members. And tell us what you have to say.
Greetings. Sorry I'm late.
No, it's okay. No, you're okay.
My name is Kelly Cross, president of the Old Goucher Community Association in Baltimore, and a resident of Center City, Baltimore, where the jail is located. Just had a few words I wanted to share with you all today, and very good to see you all today. Thank you for having me. A little over 3 years ago, shortly after Governor Hogan's closure of the jail complex, I brought together a group of people with an expansive vision for the site. Two billionaires, one from Europe, one from the U.S., two of the most prominent architects and urban planners in the U.S., First Lady Yumi Hogan, and several members of the governor's cabinet. The vision conceived for that site was breathtaking, a redevelopment centered around one of the few remaining 19th century jails in America, an arts, cultural, and commercial destination that would not only serve the people of Baltimore and Maryland, but would bring in tourists from all over the world. A new vision for the jail, perfectly situated dead center in Baltimore City, would spark positive transformation of all the neighborhoods around it. When Baltimore's former mayor, Catherine Pugh, balked at the last minute on a trip to Europe to meet with potential investors, some of the people who wanted to put money into this project, interest in the project began to evaporate. If the city's own leadership was not enthusiastic about the project, why would international investors be interested in Baltimore or in Maryland? But with new leadership emerging in Baltimore and a fresh, progressive vision on how to develop the city, it's worth putting the brakes on the current proposal. Not only would demolition of any historic portions of the jail be a travesty, but the notion of rebuilding more prison facilities in the center of Baltimore City runs counter to everything we know about how to restore and reconnect Baltimore's neighborhoods. The jail complex creates a chasm between City Center Baltimore and East Baltimore. It segregates our neighborhoods. Its location in the center of the city sends out a symbolic message that crime and imprisonment are the defining features of the city. Let's be clear, we don't need a new prison in the center of Baltimore. But I can think of a far more appropriate site, and that would be Port Covington in South Baltimore. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any questions on this item or any other questions on the Secretary's agenda?
On the Secretary's agenda, item 11, I would just point out that it's a Smith Island clean water, but there are a couple of other items like that which refer to being constructed in accordance with the coastal and non-coastal resiliency guidelines developed as part of the Coast Smart program. And I just want to thank the department for putting that in, for keeping us on top of it, and for making sure, I hope, we will see the day soon when the majority of the projects that come before us, not just in natural resources or environment, will have gone through the same sort of scrutiny and be able to say that, yes, we are building them with an eye towards resiliency in the future in the face of climate change. So I'm just, thank you all.
Great, thank you. Is there a motion?
Could I just say something about the previous item which caught my eye? I hate to bring it up, I guess, but it is a historic edifice, which is the Catholic Church up in Baltimore that's receiving, someone's receiving a big chunk of money. And apparently it's going to the Ministry of Brewing, because in this wonderful...
Ministry of what?
Brewing.
M-O-B.
Yes. Let me just read this. It's a $750,000 grant through the Neighborhood Business Works Program to the Ministry of Brewing, LLC, for improvements, furniture, fixtures, and equipment. And 15,000 square feet of leased space in a former Roman Catholic church located in the Upper Fells Point area of Baltimore. The 130-year-old church, which is listed on the National Register of Historic Places, closed in 2011. A development team of very prominent people is converting it into a brew pub. So I just want to, for the record, say, as a wonderful advocate of Maryland craft beer, this is a wonderful symmetry and convergence of interests, and I'm sure that the folks that are doing this are going to be very successful. And I think the church, to the extent it is maintained as far as its historic features, is going to be truly a magnet for new young people to come to Baltimore and witness and live in one of the greatest cities in America, particularly in one of the most unique neighborhoods of that district. And I'm delighted to see the both spiritual and alcoholic partnership, I guess, that this represents. And take my hat off to the folks that had the courage to move forward with this. And thank you very much, Governor, for your administration's support. I hesitate to toss the ball to you, but, you know.
I really didn't know about the Ministry of Brewing, but seems like it might help generate some new interest in the church, maybe.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's I'm an Episcopalian, so good.
On the last item, I'll just point out again that what we're talking about is tearing down these old buildings so that we can provide drug treatment and mental health counseling, which is desperately needed, as opposed to building a new jail facility. But any other questions, or is there a motion to approve?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. We'll move on to the DNR real property agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller. We have 11 items on our real property agenda today for which we are seeking approval, and we are withdrawing item 1A.
Questions on the real property agenda? Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. Next, we're going to go to the Department of Budget and Management.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. For the record, I'm David Brinkley, Secretary of the Department of Budget and Management. We brought 17 items for today's agenda. I have people here to address any questions or concerns you might have. Also, you may recall that the June 5th meeting, I withdrew an item. That is back on your agenda as item 15S for MPT because we have verified that the tax clearance number has been satisfied.
Great. Any questions on DBM?
I do have a question on 4S, the Health Department. I'm not opposed to it. The Health Department scanning project. I just want to make sure that in outsourcing it to this company, and I understand why you're proposing the outsourcing, that all of the privacy protection mandates are going to be not only in place but monitored.
May it please the Board, good morning. My name is Dana Dembro, Director of Procurement for the Maryland Department of Health. And yes, indeed, all requirements will be monitored. In the case of using preferred providers, we have the benefit not only of Department of Health staff making sure that jobs are done adequately, completely, and confidentially where required, which is often the case with health records. We have the support of Maryland Works. So this preferred provider will be doubly supervised, and I think that you need not have concern about release of confidential information.
Just to know, my experience, as you know, Dana, over the years has been too often when we outsource things, we think we've taken care of it, and when the next budget comes, the oversight lapses. And it's just something I think we have to be.
I'll ask Adrian Basie to have a second look at this and verify with your office in a follow-up that, indeed, we will be monitoring this contract very carefully. I should point out this involves simply a scanning of information into OCR that goes into the cloud, so it's retrievable by optical character recognition later. But there's not a great opportunity for divulging information as there would be in a computer database system, for example.
Thank you.
Other questions on DVM?
Item 6S.
6S. Emily Brandenburg?
Yes, I'm here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning. This is apparently a request from, is it your department that's requesting this?
Requesting the item.
Emily, why don't you introduce yourself and your
department? Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm Emily Brandenburg. I'm the Deputy for Finance at MSDE. This contract is to provide advanced research and data analysis for the Child Care Subsidy Program.
Terrific. No, I'm delighted you're here, because, and I'm not obviously upset with MSDE.
Thank you. And it's much
this is a one of those old chestnuts that was before us on March 6th, and correct. We deferred action because the department at that point was unable to identify the origin of the amazing budget bill language in 2018 that prohibits Towson University and a group within Towson University called Regional Economic Studies Institute, RESI, which was the incumbent provider of these services. There was legislative language in the budget that banned them from participating in the procurement for a replacement contract. In fact, RESI submitted a proposal, which I think MSDE rejected, citing the budget bill language. So I'd like to ask again, was this budget bill language requested by your agency?
No. MSD did not request the budget bill language.
And do you have any idea who offered it and why they offered it?
So my understanding is that DBM has provided additional information in a memo. I think it went out on Monday. And I would certainly feel more comfortable if DBM wanted to address those questions directly, as they were the author of the memo.
Okay, why don't we have DBM address that?
Have you got anything on that, Mark?
I haven't seen any memo from Monday.
Mark Nicole is the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Budget Management.
Good afternoon, Mr. Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. Mark Nicole, Deputy Secretary of DBM. Mr. Comptroller, we had a there was concern previously expressed with the quality of the analyses that the folks at Towson University had prepared. Legislative staff had remarked on those to us previously, and we believe that it was sort of their staff's interpretation that the quality of the analysis was not adequate at the time. There had been some concerns around some changes in federal regulations and the ability of RESI to adequately predict the financial and fiscal impacts of those regulations. And they had predicted a lot more spending would occur. That spending did not materialize, which resulted in a lot of federal funds that went unspent for many years, which could have been used to get children off a wait list. And so there was a lot of concerns with the legislative staff, with legislators who were kind of upset that we could have been serving more kids at the time than we were.
Right, but isn't it the responsibility of MSDE, the expert agency, to make that request? Why would we, in a supposedly fair and transparent and competitive procurement system, award a single bid contract to a Tennessee company and specifically prohibit the agency from, apparently they thought they were not allowed to consider the RESI application, where they could have made the decision on the merits as to whether the previous performance was worthy of renewal or not. Instead, we have this mysterious process of behind, you know, somehow it happened, the language got put in, nobody knows who did it or what, or I can understand your explanation, but it's a little after the fact, in my view. So I'm very concerned about this particular contract. I'm going to vote against it, not because I don't think the work that's being done is important. I do. Obviously it is. But because of the way in which this single-bid contract is being presented to us with a very reputable university, Towson University, essentially being told, no, you're not even allowed to submit a proposal. I just think that is the wrong use of the budget process and the wrong use of the procurement process.
So the Attorney General's office did look at that particular language and the restriction in it and ruled that that was a sort of valid use of legislative authority in the budget bill.
Well, that's also disappointing. So thank you very much.
Is this a can you think of any other, Mark, can you think of any other examples where a legislator or legislators would introduce legislation to interfere with the procurement process to specifically prohibit a Maryland operation from participating, therefore requiring a single bid from an out-of-state company?
I am not aware of any such instance before.
And it's the testimony of MSD that they did not request this of the legislature. Very strange.
Does MSDE
circumstance
disagree about the product of? I mean, there were millions of dollars.
No, in short, why we didn't request the budget bill language. There were concerns about accuracy of the projections from the Regional Economic Studies Institute of Towson University.
Yeah, but that's
like you didn't go to the legislature to ask them to put in legislation.
We didn't ask; it got put in. But yes, we had concerns with the accuracy of their projections.
This doesn't seem like an executive branch agency should go to the legislature to get them to interfere in a procurement process, or that the legislature should be inserting themselves into the process. I mean, I tend to agree with the comptroller's concerns here. What would be the impact of us delaying this item again? Do we get more information about how this occurred and why?
Governor, can I make one additional comment? And that the
thank you.
One additional comment that I would have is this was restrictive language saying that Towson University was not allowed to bid on this particular contract in fiscal year 2019 and it be awarded to them in fiscal year 2019. So the restriction really is 1 year. It expires at the end of June. So certainly there is an ability to
end of this month.
At the end of this month to take a different approach here.
What would the approach be?
To go out and do another procurement and allow everyone, including Towson University, to bid on the contract.
Yeah. Good. I'd make that motion that this particular proposal be rejected and that the agency move forward, Towson or whatever, whoever's MSDE, move forward with a truly open, transparent procurement that is not burdened, shall I say, by legislative budget language.
I'll second. All those in favor? All those opposed? Motion carries 3-0.
3-0 disapproved.
Disapproved.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions on DBF?
Make a motion for the rest.
Is there a motion?
There is, but I just wanted to comment on item 14, since I raised some concerns.
Greg James.
Chair James.
Good morning, members of the board. I'm Greg James, Deputy Secretary for Operations, right, the Maryland Department of Human Services.
And I'm going to be candid and say I appreciate what your response from the agency has been. I understand that we don't want to affect any of the kids that are involved in this situation, so I'm going to vote to approve this current situation before us, but I hope that in the future the 32 Maryland companies that provide foster care contractual services to you are the ones that are brought back before us to the extent possible. And I appreciate the situation that you're in, and I don't want to obviously affect any of a small number of children, but I hope that we don't see this situation down the road, because I think this issue is going to become larger rather than smaller.
Okay. Thank you.
I assume you support forward with your expertise and figure out how pragmatically to accomplish something that is that I'm referring to, and I appreciate the information that you have provided. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor. Thank you for your support.
Thank you.
Governor, item 12. Mr. Secretary.
Yeah.
So this is essentially the same fleet list potential for the state to buy as last year.
Right.
And I looked through the list, and I looked through the policy, and considering the fact that MDOT and everyone else agrees that transportation is the greatest producer of greenhouse gas emissions, and that the state should be a leader, and we should focus on reducing emissions, this item shows absolutely no recognition of that whatsoever. And when asked, we are told that the Electric Vehicles Commission is looking at it and will come back with something else next year. We are supposed to reduce emissions by 40% by 2030. 2030 is 10 and a half years from now. It's not a long time. And we are not being a very good role model. I'd like to hear you explain why we are and why I'm mistaken.
Madam Treasurer, this is Joe Consoli. He's, when did you come on? Last year.
Last year.
We brought him on board to handle the transportation issues. And you and I had a conversation yesterday about this, and I know Joe, when he goes into this, is going to, I think he's sick and tired of me drilling in this same issue about our fleet conversion. So go ahead, Joe.
Good morning. Thank you for having
me.
I too am a believer in the green vehicle transition.
So we're all believers, but here's a chance when we could do something and we're not doing it.
And what we've done is, as every year, but this year in particular, we extended invitations to all the manufacturers who are out there, basically, to come meet with us and talk about what they did provide in different vehicle type categories. And we listed each vehicle type category to have the hybrids. We basically are offering, we'll have contracts for every electric-based vehicle available out there for the government agencies to purchase. We are pushing forward with that. We want to make sure that those things, and I relayed that to all the fleet managers throughout the state, that we are pushing this. Also, though, to add to that, Section 42 of the budget, the amendment or the adjustment this year, will cause us to be purchasing approximately 65 electric or plug-in hybrid vehicles to meet the mandate by the legislature. And that will actually put us in advance of or beyond our current requirements for a percentage of our eligible fleet to be green. So after FY20, when these vehicles are purchased, we'll be in a good stead in terms of our progression towards our percentages and meeting what was required of us.
So Joe, touch base also on what's available for state services. We have different needs as we go to the shore, Western Maryland, then the metropolitan areas. You and I have been talking about what manufacturers are out there and what we possibly can do from a fleet perspective.
Obviously, this comes into infrastructure as well, which we're working on with other agencies. But the manufacturers basically are offering sedans, compact sedans, mid-sized sedans, a crossover or a compact SUV, and a minivan, a full-size minivan. Those are the things that they're offering, an electric, plug-in, or just straight hybrid.
I read your list.
Yes, you did. So those are the things we're having available to everybody throughout the state. But without significant or sufficient infrastructure, certain places just don't have the range to be able to use the straight vehicle, the straight electric vehicle. The plug-in hybrid is nice because you do get about a 20-mile boost of electric-only operation before it kicks into the hybrid version. So I know we are trying very hard to push and to advance this particular thing. And with our purchase standards, we did try to include everything that was currently available.
So you included a lot of stuff, but where is the leadership?
The leadership will follow once we get our contracts and we can actually go to the agencies and say, these are things we would suggest you buy, and as opposed to buying a combustion engine vehicle. This vehicle could also suit or fill your need.
And I'll point out that the vehicle that we had for DBM staff use was 18 years old. We just replaced that with a used vehicle that we got from another agency.
That was 7 years old.
That's 7 years old. That we're so you have a fleet transition issue too. He's trying to make sure that we have a product line that is adequate to whatever function it might have and is compliant with that. The other thing we'll then need to do is to make sure that we have been in conversations with DGS about ensuring that we have some plug-in facilities here in Annapolis and also at some of the
As I understand it, the governor has devoted a significant amount of the Volkswagen money to setting up electric capacity around the state. We are doing that. But who is going to tell all these people that you can choose from any of these, but this is the one, it's the state's policy, we've got to reduce emissions 40 by 30, 50 by 40. And in order to do that, this is what the state is expecting of you.
We can be the leader there. We can absolutely push that upon the agencies that are preference.
And how will we know that you're doing that? What are the indicators that will show us that, in fact, our fleet, for which we are responsible, is turning into the low emissions fleet that we want, or the no emissions fleet that we want?
I think year-to-year numbers of purchases will demonstrate the increase of that product line into our fleet.
And during the year?
Yeah, I think you can, in your inventory that you have, we can get that information to you, too. I know that I drive it. Mine's a 2013 hybrid. It's not the most efficient from today's perspective, but it is what was available to the previous secretary, and I've kept that car in service. And again, I've been all over Joe about what can we offer that is functional, meets the purpose of the agencies and the personnel, and yet also we don't leave people stranded on the roads, and I think that's where we're working with DGS.
I've been driving, as you know, hybrid Ford since I essentially became treasurer, and I've never been stranded.
Yours is
I haven't driven
either.
It.
Yeah, I don't think yours is plug-in either, is it?
No, it's not. Yeah. It's not at all the latest model.
Yeah. No, hybrids are wonderful vehicles, and you're right. You'll never be stranded. You'll extend your range because you're using electric power and combustible gas.
But somebody, I was disturbed when I got the message, well, next year we'll make changes. Next year the EBIC will do something. We don't have a lot of years in which to make changes. And I don't know, sir, whether you're the person, whether DBM is even the department, but somehow the state has got to take ownership of this issue.
I believe, and I could be corrected, that the money that was allotted from the VW settlement for the installation of infrastructure was in large part put under the direction of MDE to be discussed with other agencies as well. So that's part of the
mission. So you want MDE to direct people?
Well, part of what they're using it also, they're using a lot of it out at the port facilities. They're supposed to get some diesel emission vehicles out of service, put some electric or propane or some other alternative type of fuel in service. I think you're doing that with some forklifts and some other opportunities. But then we're also looking for the infrastructure.
And we're placing electric buses at the airport.
Right.
So we'll have a fleet of electric buses at the airport.
Well, that's great. Every piece helps. But here we are talking about the state's fleet.
And Madam Treasurer, it'll be the responsibility of DBM. Joe's been on board now for a year to help us with that transition. His predecessor, unfortunately, Larry Williams died in office, and we had 18 months to get him on board. So that has impacted our transition. But now we're also trying to ensure that what's available in the marketplace will allow us to do it. And I think we're getting some positive feedback, as I understand, finally. But then we also have to ensure that we're in collusion in getting some of the infrastructure in place.
And I also discussed with the manufacturers at our meeting in May that this was Maryland's position. We are going green. We are absolutely interested in any type of hybrid plug-in electric.
We are not the only ones who are doing this. They have a significant market.
I have colleagues throughout the country who are doing California and other places doing a lot. But I wanted to let them know that we are no longer in the game just for combustion engines. We really, really, really are pushing to go to a green.
So how will we know? How do we set up a system of reporting?
I'll get you updates on some of this aspect. Some of our budget, this is outside of the hybrid and plug-in aspect, but our conversations from a budgetary perspective with agencies is, what vehicles do you have? How many are you using? Are we getting the mileage out of them? That's
and
part
do we
of the
need
criteria.
All the cars that we've got?
Do you need all the ones that you have? Are you using the ones that you do have? And in that turnover process, we've been focused on it. We've had conversations with state police. To what effect can they implement this type of guidelines based on their the mileage that they do, and also some of the demands on theirs. And we're looking for opportunities.
So
just
you're saying this is a work in progress, and we will keep on top of it. And we will know, because we will develop together some metrics.
Yes.
So that we can see that progress.
Absolutely.
Before next year.
Absolutely. And there are also, for the record, there are actually hybrid police pursuit rated vehicles that are available, will be available in the country. It is incredible. And it actually, being a retired Maryland State Trooper, I can tell you a lot of our time, any police officer, is spent not in idle time. A lot of energy is expelled by the combustion engine, a lot of time on the motor.
Good point.
So you're developing mileage on that motor, even though it's not driving anywhere. But when it kicks into a hybrid mode, it's strictly a battery function, and it doesn't take away from any of the function that the police vehicle can do. And yet you're extending your MPG, you're extending all those things. So they are also included in the package as well. We're trying to piece everything we can in to get to the broader picture of making our fleet as green as possible.
Thank you. I look forward to this continuing conversation.
Could you get me a picture of the treasurer in the police vehicle?
If she was like that,
yes, I would love to see that.
I could make that happen.
Hybrid, yes.
I could. I'll follow up. Yes,
I'll be there.
Thank you.
Governor, I had a question on item 17. You obviously know this issue. I don't have any problem with the state center part of it, but I do with the $85,290 allocation to cover legal costs for Howard County District Court Judge Mary Reese. She was sanctioned by the Maryland Commission of Judicial Disabilities following a complaint filed by the Women's Law Center in Maryland on her conduct at two domestic violence protective order hearings. That was ultimately overturned by the Court of Appeals, and she has filed for $85,000 plus in legal costs. This is not a complaint over the decision that she made. It simply is a complaint about the advice and the conduct that apparently was exhibited in her courtroom. On one instance, there was a less than 4-minute hearing on whether to provide a protective order to a 17-year-old woman standing before the court, her, the judge, with a black eye. 4 minutes. Secondly, in another similar situation, the judge gave advice when, quote, when you're picking a fight with him, this is to a young woman, when you're picking a fight with him and he wants you out of the house or out of the car and you're not leaving, then you got to expect to lose the fight. So, we entrust our judges to be neutral umpires, to call balls and strikes, not to offer unwarranted and unnecessary comments that seem to normalize domestic violence or perfunctory hearings that fail to provide an opportunity for justice. So, obviously, judges like Mary Reese hold immense power. They are not, however, immune to holding high professional standards. And I consider the standard here not to have been met, and I'm voting against the $85,230 bill that she submitted to the state for her legal expenses. Obviously, she was entitled to get an attorney and go before a court. It's entirely appropriate, but I don't think it's appropriate for the state taxpayers to foot her legal bill, given the context of her comments. So I would like to vote for the state senator allocation, not for the Judge Mary Reese allocation, if that's possible.
Is there a motion?
And I will make that motion.
Pull that
well.
Out.
Kathy heard about Judge Reese.
Are you Phil Andrews?
I am.
If you have some questions, I have him here to address any questions you might have. If you've come to the conclusion,
I'm
move forward. So.
Just going from the record.
Counsel for Judge Reese.
Yeah.
Pardon? He's counsel for Judge Reese. I'm telling you, he Phil Andrews is too.
I mean, we don't have anyone signed up to speak here. So.
No, we did not get a request.
I have Phil Andrews and Mark Nicole if we need to get into any details.
I do have a question about this.
Phil, why don't you come up to the mic?
I just have some factual questions, and I understand, I believe, the history of this particular incident, but I want to make sure. The judge chose to go before an administrative board and did not ask for representation from the Office of Attorney General, right?
For the record, Philip Andrews on behalf of Judge Mary Reese. I appreciate the board hearing me out. Good morning to all three of you. To answer your question, Madam Treasurer, my understanding is there was a conversation that Judge Reese had with someone from the Attorney General's office, and because this was an administrative proceeding against her.
And there's no precedent for the Attorney General.
That is my understanding. That's what I understand the judge was told. So had she been a state employee who had been sued for doing her job, and I would like a moment just to address the context in light of the comptroller's comments, had she been a state employee who had been sued, then the Attorney General's office would have offered her representation. Of course, the Attorney General's office represents
it was the state that ruled against her.
The commission. I'm sorry?
It was the state that found her guilty of this inappropriate comment.
Well, if I may, Governor.
The Judicial Grievance Commission is not just some perfunctory group. It's the group that's charged with reviewing judicial conduct.
It is, but it is supposed to be a place where there is due process and fairness, and this is a public servant
who was doing her
job. And was actually on the two cases, if I could address the context. One case, the Lewis case, there were two cases that were investigated and prosecuted for 3 years. She went through this process. At the end of the process, after a trial, if you will, in front of the commission dismissed one of the cases. That was the one about the comment, if you pick a fight with him. It turned out the reason that case was dismissed is that the woman, the wife seeking the petition, was actually found to be the aggressor. And the judge's words of advice were, don't pick a fight with somebody. You're not going to win that fight. But the commission ended up dismissing that one after the trial. The other issue with the 17-year-old had to do with this. Grandmother, 17-year-old granddaughter, walk into the courtroom. They're called up. This is an ex parte proceeding. So the respondent, the person against whom the peace order is sought, is not there. The grandmother comes up with her granddaughter, and Judge Reese says, good morning. And the grandmother, says, former boyfriend 2 weeks ago, tracked her down to a friend's house by using her phone, and came in and assaulted her. At that point, Judge Reese encouraged the grandmother to provide the information. That was the evidence. Then turns to the granddaughter and says, ma'am, what would you like to tell me? And the granddaughter says, everything she said is true. The judge said, well, has he done this before? Did you have a conversation with him that day? No, I've blocked him on my phone. And I haven't heard from him. The judge says, well, it sounds like you're taking care of it. And then the judge said, he waited to see if there was anything else. There was no other evidence forthcoming. And the judge said, I have a statute to apply. It says I have to find that there's a reasonable belief. I have to have a reasonable belief that not only did this person commit the assault, but also that he's likely to do it again. And she said, I find the second aspect missing. And so the statute isn't satisfied. She didn't rush anybody through. Yes, it was a brief hearing. This is district court. This is ex parte. And there's not been a bit of suggestion in front of the commission or anywhere else that there was some evidence the judge should have heard or that the judge shooed people away. And at that point, she said, I cannot issue the peace order under these circumstances. The statute will not allow me to do it.
Did she have a black eye? But the Maryland the Commission on Judicial Disability, which is charged with overseeing the conduct of judges, it's the appropriate body. The Women's Law Center took this complaint to them, and they found that Judge Reese committed sanctionable conduct and ruled against her. So you're asking for the state to pay for her legal fees before that commission of the state where she lost. Is that correct?
Yes,
and
went on to the Court of Appeals, Governor,
what was the ruling of the Court of Appeals? How did their decision differ from the lower?
They found that what the judge did was entirely proper and that these were absolutely groundless allegations. Judges, the rule says, what a judge is supposed to do is hear the evidence, apply the law to the evidence that's presented, and make a decision. That's what she did. That's exactly what she did. And if you look at the rules, and these are the rules she was prosecuted under, it says that doing that is not sanctionable conduct. Now, you're right, Governor, the Grievance Commission pushed it through, but the Court of Appeals, which ultimately heard it, and you don't have to take my word for it, found that these allegations were utterly without merit. It should not have been brought.
And so it was just the opinion of the Court of Appeals that the body responsible for overseeing the judge was completely crazy and they had no merit whatsoever?
I wouldn't use the word crazy, but the allegations had no merit. That's exactly what the Court of Appeals found.
So they didn't have to find a specific thing where they erred. They just said, no, we disagree with all of them.
They said the sanctionable conduct doesn't get into
they just
whether
felt
the right
it wasn't sanctionable. Is that correct?
I'm sorry?
They didn't necessarily disagree with the conduct didn't take place. They just said they didn't believe it. They didn't agree with the decision to sanction her. Is that correct?
They disagreed with because the court said there's no legal basis to do what the commission did. And so, again, this is a public service.
Is that why the commission process has been changed?
The attorney general could not represent the judge because the state was going after her?
Because the state agency going after her, yes. And so if she'd been sued.
So we're basically, you want us to pay both sides of the prosecution and for defense.
Well, it seems that when we have a public servant who has to pay substantial monies to defend herself for doing her job, and the Court of Appeals said she did her job, this is not sanctionable conduct, that yes, because, again, if she'd been sued, the Attorney General's office would have provided a defense.
And the legal fees would be for both the lower court where she was found guilty and the upper courts, how does it break down?
These are the fees for the proceeding, the investigation, and the prosecution, if you will, by the Disabilities Commission, and then on up through the Court of Appeals.
Do you have any idea how it breaks down between the appeal and the original case that went against her?
I don't stand it here. No, Governor, I don't. But it is, again, it is, she's doing her job. And the other thing I would say is, when this was appealed to the Circuit Court and the Women's Law Center was representing her and the respondent showed up with counsel, the Circuit Court judge didn't issue the peace order either. She was just doing her job. And the message that it sends to judges, it's easy to say, sure, well, I'll just issue a peace order.
But did you represent her before the Court of Appeals?
I didn't. My partner, Andy Graham, did.
Did you not go to the Court of Appeals and ask for the attorney's fees or?
And the only mechanism,
and they didn't rule on that.
They did. The only mechanism
they
for
did.
That is on a is.
Well,
is
if
for
they
bad
did, why is it before us?
Well, because there. Let me back up. I'm sure answer your question, Governor. There was a request made to the Court of Appeals, but it was under a rule that says the Court of Appeals would have to find bad faith. It's a very high standard. There are a few cases where fees are awarded under that rule, and so the Court of Appeals said, denied it. We are here because this board has before, in the Judge Clyburn case, through an appropriations, has reimbursed a judge for attorney's fees. And this circumstance where she was found to be, her conduct was found to be utterly proper by the Court of Appeals.
So the Court of Appeals ruled against you on paying her legal fees, but you have the right to come before us to ask for it anyway.
Yes.
Is that correct?
And the reason the Court of Appeals ruled against her, Governor, is because the standard is extremely high. And so this is a public...
I'm sure why we should have a different standard than the Court of Appeals. We should
I trust
their judgment.
I think it's a question of fairness and what public servants may expect, particularly a judge who is simply doing her job and finds herself at the end of this three-year process.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, but I just come back to my original point. Wasn't this 17-year-old young woman standing before the judge with a black eye?
But that's part of it. And she didn't say, I don't know where you got that black eye. That's one half of what the burden of proof is. The judge is a neutral arbiter. She's not the investigator. She's not the prosecutor. She's not the lawyer for the petitioner. I mean, remember, there's a respondent there. He's got rights as well. So,
well,
I appreciate that, and obviously I have great respect for you and your partner who represent folks. I just think it's completely inappropriate, as I said, to use state tax dollars to pay for the legal expenses of Judge Reese, who got sanctioned by the Commission on Judicial Disabilities and then had that overturned by the court, understanding that this is a two-step process. I just find it unbelievable that the defense is apparently they didn't explicitly prove that the person was going to come and punch her again.
That's
what the other eye?
That's what the statute says. If the statute said anybody who wants a petition, anybody who wants a peace order, just come on down, you get one automatically, it'd be a different situation.
I don't want to argue the merits of the case and what she did or didn't do. I'm just stating the facts that we know. The Judicial Disabilities Commission ruled against her. The Court of Appeals ruled against you on legal fees. So now we have to make a determination, but we can't relitigate the entire case of what she did, whether we think she did something wrong or not. It's a question of whether or not we want to go beyond what the Court of Appeals did by granting you a special circumstance of paying for these fees, and I tend to agree with the comptroller. I mean, I'm going to vote no.
Well, the commission's ruling at this point is a nullity because the Court of Appeals, which has the ultimate authority, determined that the allegations were utterly, utterly without merit. And so you can leave a public servant to spend that amount of money, even at reduced hourly rates, to spend that amount of money after tax dollars, if I may, Mr. Comptroller, of her own savings to defend herself in a proceeding that was determined to be absolutely without merit. The fairness of that, the message that sends to judges, and she was just doing her job, applying the statute the way it's written, not the way people might like it to be written, is beyond unfair.
Mr. Andrews,
yes.
As I understand it, just the Disabilities Commission found one thing.
Yes.
It was appealed to the Court of Special
Court of Appeals.
Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals said that was a mistake, that it was a wrong decision.
Yes.
Then the judge appealed for reimbursement of expenses, essentially, in layman's language.
Yes.
And the court said no. Did they give a reason for saying no?
No. It was just a ruling denying the motion. And the thing to keep in mind, Madam Treasurer, is that the rule that allows for a court to award attorney's fees is what's called sort of the bad faith rule. It's a very, very high standard for the sorts of things that I'm talking to the board about today: public servant fairness, utterly meritless result, finally, doesn't come into play. So there's a limited avenue there. That was available. And as you pointed out, Madam Treasurer, as a result of this case and some others, the procedures, a lot of which were very unfair to Judge Reese, lack of discovery, ex parte communications with the investigative counsel, those have been changed. So this, in a lot of ways, is a one-off case, but it really cries out.
And there is precedent for this board in the past reimbursing. This was before
yes,
when
Judge Clyburn,
16
years ago. These cases don't come up very often. We believe this one for all the reasons I've said, and I appreciate the board hearing me. Merits the right message being sent to public servants like Judge Reese, who was just doing her job.
Thank you.
So I would move to pull this item out and support the state center legal fee allocation and not the...
Well, aren't these two different items?
Right. So
totally
we can do a separate vote on item 17.
Then I can just...
Right. Item 17 is the one that Mr.
Totally
Andrew was
discussing. So I can
move for disapproval.
Move that item 17 be denied.
I'll second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Opposed?
This is taking it out of what... I can't agree with you. I do think there is an issue... that the judge should not, having defended herself, having been supported by the Court of Appeals, and the Disciplinary Commission recognizing their problems and having changed the procedures after this case, that she should be personally out of pocket almost $90,000 doesn't seem to me right. I recognize what you're saying, but it just doesn't seem right to me that a public servant like that should have to be out of pocket $90,000 when her position in the end was upheld by the court. So I can't go with that. On the other hand, I do have a problem with 16.
So can we vote on 17?
So let's finish the vote.
I just
want to add.
Two to one on 17.
But I also want to add, and I obviously respect the treasurer, but I hear all the time of evidence, incidents of domestic abuse where the male spouse blames the female for causing and being the aggressor and, I guess, fomenting the violence somehow that he inflicts upon her. And that, unfortunately, is something I think our society needs to deal with much more aggressively. And so whatever changes were made in the process, I hope that the Women's Law Center and other advocates are monitoring all that very closely, because proof positive that there is the second claim is made is when you look at the young woman with a black eye. Really, to me, because that inevitably is going to be repeated if there is any contact between those two people. So, you know, I am very comfortable saying that it's entirely appropriate in this instance to have the judge pay her own legal fees. And feel very strongly about that just because of the imbalance in power that exists out there.
Could I just say, I didn't think I had to say this, but I am opposed to domestic violence, and I recognize the inequities that women face. Trust me, I do. But I think we have to look not only at general concerns and problems, but at a specific case with specific people in a specific set of circumstances. And that's what causes me to say, in this instance, it is not clear to me that the judge should have to pay $90,000 when even the Court of Appeals said she was essentially following the law and doing her duty. On the other hand, with 16, I think it's quite clear, Governor, you had concerns with what the legislature did in the budget.
Can we finish
the vote? Yeah, Mark said, item 17 has been disapproved.
2-1 on item 17.
We've got that. Now we got the rest of the agenda. But
now we're going to go back to the rest of the agenda.
I was simply explaining that I had a social conscience.
We irony.
But
I think everybody.
But on 16, there was an issue earlier today about the use of the budget power and the Department of Education, as I recall.
Yeah.
In this one, it's quite clear the legislature was properly exerting its efforts to follow its responsibility, to carry out its responsibilities, and voting against this expenditure, both in a 2019 deficiency and 2020. And I don't think this board should be attempting to overturn that action by the legislature. So I think we're probably going to be 2-1.
Sure, it's not quite that clear. This was a unanimous decision by the Board of Public Works several years ago to vote against the capital leases, which
it was,
we thought.
And I regret that to this day.
So this deal was dead. We have this failed developer that has not done anything with this site for 14 years. We're involved in a lawsuit. These expenses for legal fees were incurred from December of 2018 through February of 2019. After the fact, the legislature inappropriately came back and tried to push a budget cut that would say, keep us from paying our responsibilities in the executive branch for expenses that already occurred, and attempted to unconstitutionally exert the power they don't have to require another 3-0 vote of the Board of Public Works, which they have. The Attorney General has already ruled that they have no power to make that kind of a decision.
Can I
let me just say that
other funds than the contingency fund.
Since they deleted these monies out of the budget for money that we needed to spend to pay our lawyer's fees, the only money remaining to pay our bills is out of this contingency fee, which there's $500,000 and most of this money. That's what the contingency fee is for, so we can pay our bills in a case like this where the legislature does something stupid and takes away the money that we needed to pay the bills with. So I think that if you want to make a motion to pull that one out, I think that...
Sure. If I can move to
there's
that
a second. Motion fails to have a second. So...
But she's going to be voting against this item.
Yeah. Okay, we can pull it out. I'll second to her motion to pull it out, and then we can... Vote on that item separately.
Right.
I'm going to vote in favor of the motion. And
the motion is to spend
state
the
to approve state senate litigation.
Yes.
Motion carries 2-1.
Thank you. We are good on 16 and 17 now.
I will say the best way to deal with this issue that we're dancing around, and it comes up beforehand, and it's come up in multiple instances, I would love to see a videotape of these conference committee votes where these language items fall out of the ceiling, I guess. Nobody takes credit for anything. I'm probably never going to find the person that put the Towson language in. But I wish that in the future we would film the meetings in the back room where these little actions are taken so that at least we know from whence they come.
Yeah, on this last item, I don't want to get into a he said, she said, but just the legislature in trying to stop us from paying our legal bills to defend the state in this action potentially it could cost taxpayers up to $100 million in losses. So it's total lack of regard for fiscal responsibility, in my opinion, and an interference, and they don't have the power to do it.
Point out to the comptroller that all these were approved on the floor in a recorded vote. Who sponsors a bill for an amendment that he needs not to put in?
I think his question is where it came from, you know, who influenced them to come up with an idea like that. Are there any other questions on the DBM agenda? Is there a motion? Second? 3-0 on the remainder of the agenda. Now we're going to move on to the university system.
Good morning, Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 8 items on the agenda.
Joe, we might give you a break while we clear the room. You're making a lot of noise back there. We want to make sure we can pay attention to you.
Don't take it personally. It's not that they don't.
They're not walking out on you. It's just that we just cleared a whole lot of things off the agenda. It's not a protest of the university system or you personally.
It usually happens in the DBM.
Every time you come up, it seems like people walk out. We should probably reorder the thing so Joe doesn't always get walked out. All right. Thank you.
Again, Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 8 items on the agenda here to answer any questions.
Any questions on the University System agenda?
I just wanted to ask an item about one of my favorite universities, Salisbury University. I call it the Yale University of Maryland because it's such a outstanding institution. But there's an item on the item. Is it 1C?
The DNR secretary just gave a little shout out because she's a graduate of the Yale University of Maryland.
Good. So the item is a very important item for not just the university but also downtown Salisbury. And I understand that it's a single bid proposal you're putting before us. And could you just explain how that happened?
I would like to bring up Bill Olin, who is the executive director for design and construction at University of Maryland College Park.
Great.
Thank you.
Good morning, Governor, Comptroller, Treasurer. Bill Olin, Executive Director of College Park Service Center. Comptroller, your question. We advertised the project. We requested technical proposals from qualified firms. We received them. And then after further review by the three firms where they were asked to give us a price, two of the firms decided not to participate in the price component of the project.
So that's why we have a single bid contract.
Okay. So
we got three technical proposals, just to be clear.
Right. But you have the wrong concept, with all due respect. I have been a huge advocate for design, bid, build, which would have been a perfect model for saving the state money and getting multiple competitive bids for this project. And instead, you all decided to do a design build for a relatively small internal renovation of a building project. Let me just state for the record that design build model that you used is completely inappropriate for that size project, and particularly for one that's done internally. And the reason that you lost, I think, these other two companies is that you didn't spend an extra week doing the kind of design that would have allowed, under a design bid build, multiple contractors, multiple competitors, to find out exactly what it would cost from their subcontractors. And as a result, you know, we're faced, I'm obviously going to vote for this proposal, but the idea that this is what I've been talking about is ludicrous. This is exactly the opposite, and it leads to the state taxpayers spending unnecessary money through Salisbury University for this project, and it directly results in only one bid. So you guys get a grade of F for failure as far as the procurement, and please, would you communicate to the system membership that I'm interested in design, bid, build wherever possible?
Yes, sir. We do quite a bit of design, bid, build. We also use other tools in the toolbox, cement risk and design, build. Because of this, we are finding right now, because of what's happening in the market, there isn't enough trade folks to go around. One of the advantages of design build, it didn't show in this one. I have to admit, is there's not enough folks out there to work on our projects. And projects that are risky, you know, we're having issues with that. So we do all the different types of implementation. This may have been one that just didn't work out the way we wanted. Yes, sir, it didn't.
Yeah, my understanding is, according to your documents, the other two declined to submit a price due to the risk in providing a lump sum price for design and construction.
Correct.
And then market conditions, as you indicate, that where there are opportunities elsewhere available. All I'm suggesting is, please, take it. All you needed to do is take an extra 5 working days. Very simple for an architect to complete the design so that other contractors could actually bid a reasonable price. And my opinion, and I could be completely wrong, but I think I'm right, is that the state will benefit by 15% to 20% cost savings, and we will also benefit because there will be multiple bids. So, thank you for letting me get down in the weeds on this, but please, design, bid, build, wherever possible. Am I right, Nelson, that that's the process you all use?
General Services always uses design and build.
Thank you.
It wasn't fair teaming up with Nelson.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ben. Any other questions on the university system? Is there a second? 3-0 on university system. Next, we move on to Department of Information Technology.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Mike Leahy, Secretary of the Department of Information Technology. Today we have 9 items on your agenda. 1 is supplemental, and there are agency representatives here to answer any questions.
Questions on DO-IT.
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. We're going to move on to the Department of Transportation agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Pete Ron, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Transportation. MDOT has 21 items before you today. The item 22 is a supplemental to the agenda, and at this time we are withdrawing item 9-RP, and I would add that any problems we have are clearly the fault of Mr. Nugent.
Sorry, the fault of what? I missed that.
Mr. Nugent.
Oh, it's Nugent's fault. Yeah. Good idea. I guess it's going to take them a while to get up to speed. We can finish that.
I have a question with 1. The easy pass?
Yes.
And a couple of others. It seems as though we have a problem making sure that all of our spending is in sync with the specific item that the board sees and approves. And that's in general. And it seems to be more in MDOT than other places. In this one, with you've got both retroactive and then you're piling on more money, in part, I suppose, to make up for people like me getting a free transponder. So it turns out there's nothing that's free. It's just being paid for differently. But what about the rest of the story?
Can I answer that one before you jump in?
Yes.
This is a tremendous success story for the state.
Oh, I just used it.
We not only did we eliminate the monthly fees of $1.50 a month on the Easy Pass, but then we eliminated the upfront expense of the Easy Pass to try to encourage more usage of it because it saves the state money. And the cashless tolls is the eventual goal. And the burgeoning demand has been incredible and far more than anybody could have possibly anticipated. And the demand for transponders doubled in the first 4 months after I announced the change in our policy. And so, therefore, we have to the existing contracts could not handle all of the huge demand from Marylanders that are dying to get their easy passes. But I'll let the experts tell you. That was just my fluff part of the answer.
Yeah.
But we're really proud of it.
I just drove up and back to Connecticut using Easy Pass, and it was terrific.
Yeah.
No question about it.
Should have you do a testimonial.
It is. It's wonderful. It's a great system.
Good morning, Mr. Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. I'm John O'Neill. I'm the Acting Executive Director for the Maryland Transportation Authority. And this retroactive item is to cover the transponders. As the governor stated, we had estimates of how many transponders we were going to be selling. And the price of those transponders for our vendor in 2016 came down. So we came in 2016, lowered the amount of the contract by $2 million. Then we rolled out the free transponder program, which instead of 21,000 transponders in that same time frame, we sold 173,000 transponders.
Wow.
So, and
I said double. That's like double.
So, very successful program. We have over 1.2 million active accounts, and each of those accounts has multiple transponders. Also, during this time period when we needed...
The other thing, by the way, we did, besides eliminating the monthly fee and the upfront fee, was cutting the tolls for everybody that's using them at every facility in the state. So people, it would encourage people to say, well, we better go get an Easy Pass.
That is correct. And with the governor's press release that day, we actually saw quite at least a 10% increase in individuals coming in, signing up for Easy Pass. And as we move more and more individuals to Easy Pass, because we're giving them a 25% discount over the cash rate, and in some cases, such as the Bay Bridge, 37.5% incentive to use easy pass as opposed to cash, as well as reducing the emissions, near roadway emissions, reducing crashes by 70% at our plazas, at our toll plazas, and reducing congestion, because when you need to stop to pay a toll and accelerate, there's slows traffic down and also results in more collisions. Another part of this story, there is one part of this story that we have to admit to at the Transportation Authority. We were in the middle of upgrading our Maximo inventory management system at the time that we rolled out the free transponder program, and there was a delay in the accounting for the increase in sales in the inventory system, so that resulted in a lag where we were in the contract, and we continued to sell them, which is a great story, because 173,000 additional accounts after that announcement within a year, that was our most successful year ever on getting people signed up for EasyPass. So with that small system upgrade, there was a little delay, and that was the human issue.
So what are you doing to change the system so you don't have that problem?
The system has been upgraded. It was actually in the middle of the migration when the free transponder program rolled out, and that caused some delay because it was a manual process. Now the system is in production and working as it should. It was just the timing of it was during the migration. It was just the timing of the system, and the paper process took longer than
so
the electronic process.
Actually, you're saying that your statement to us here, that it was due to human error and staff changes managing your systems and you weren't aware of it, is not so?
Well, the staff changes, there were staff changes, as well as the system change, and that's
where... I understand staff changes. Okay. I understand glitches. What I want to understand is what you've changed so that everyone has staff changes all the time, and it's a real problem, and I get that, but you still have to be on top of it.
Understood. And the staff changes is part of the story. The rest of the story, sorry.
I'm sorry. So, John, explain Maximo so that it's clear that it's the inventorying system, and with the migration to the new inventory system, it was within that period.
Okay. I'm only reading what you told us and trying to understand.
I understand, and I think there was probably more that should have been in that explanation. During that inventory system upgrade, we also had some staff changes of people who were very aware of how they manage these inventory systems. And so during the migration, the system should have told people that we were using more of these at a faster pace. The individuals that were the staffers that would have known this had moved on. So it was two issues. One was the system that would have caught it otherwise, but also at the same time you had some staffing changes that also resulted in the individual that would have known this information without the system, without looking in the system. You understand there's a lot of people with the institutional knowledge that just know everything that's going on without having to refer to the system. The system wasn't there for the new people to refer to until later because it was being upgraded, and the individual that had all the institutional knowledge was gone. So it was a unique period and a series of unfortunate events right there during the during our ramp up for the free transponders.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And knowing that there are going to be these changes in the future, since there are generational changes going on in all our agencies, you have made also, or you are on top of making changes to make sure that that sort of information is captured before people leave? And
yes, it's having more than one individual, because unfortunately a lot of times you end up with a single point of failure, and we've come to rely on individuals and all agencies on one person. Hey, they've been there 20 years. They know what's going on. Well, we're working with succession planning to make sure that there's multiple individuals that know that information. And the next time we have a major initiative such as this, we will delay our system upgrade or make sure that's completed first.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes. Item 6, please. Not sure if Administrator Quinn is here. So this is a $1.6 million retroactive
approval sought for a contract with New Flyer Industries for the 140 40-foot diesel buses. This was an $81.4 million contract we approved in 2017. According to the background materials, an employee of MTA went to up to Canada to the vendor's facility and agreed to move forward with $1.6 million worth of upgrades, thereby bypassing the proper procurement process. And I'm just wondering what the administrator has as a comment, if any, on this employee's actions.
Sure. Well, good morning.
Yes.
Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Mr. Governor, thank you for having me. First and foremost, I just want to put out there that MDOT-MTA, myself, the agency, completely understands that we do not have the authority to modify contracts. That is an authority that rests solely with the Board of Public Works. I also want to convey that, personally, I'm absolutely committed to ensuring that MTA adheres to state procurement guidelines. And this is a point that I make to my staff regularly in executive staff meetings, individual meetings, something that I stress tremendously. So since this error occurred, we've focused a lot on training. And so MTA is offering, we've put together a professional contract management training. Also, the Secretary's office has created an Office of Project Quality Assurance that's been tremendously helpful. It's overseeing a 40-hour professional contract management training class. So we have 12 MTA participants. 7 have completed that to date. So we're really committed to getting our folks trained up on this. With regard to this specific item, you're right. This was approved in June 2017 for the purchase of buses. And during the pre-production meeting with the vendor, an employee approved several items that were out of scope. And while these upgrades were safety and they were very customer service focused, they were outside the scope of the contract and they were not approved by the Board of Public Works prior to that modification. I will just note that that MTA employee is no longer employed by the agency, and the seriousness of this error has certainly been conveyed to all staff. So lastly, and you're asking for my comment, I agree with you. It's inexcusable, and I will continue to demand that the agency follow all proper procurement laws.
Kevin, let me ask you this. I think it's great that you are owned up and accept the responsibility and that you've taken you've been very proactive and they're training people so that they don't make a mistake like this, but shouldn't we have some checks and balances so that some random employee should not be able to just arbitrarily spend the state's money when they don't have the authority to do so? I mean, how do we stop that from happening in the future? So, rather than just making sure they're trained well, even if somebody is very well trained, they should never be able to commit us to spending money when they don't have the authority to do so.
Yeah, so I think, part of it is putting in place that checks and balances, being sure that that approval has to go up a couple levels before that's done. And I think training is a key piece of this. This isn't something that we really had at the agency before. And so, my thinking about it is, when we have new employees come on board that we know are going to be overseeing contracts, they've got to undergo this training. This just can't be in every year and then someone joins and 12 months later then they get the training. No, they need it right when they come in the front door.
Kevin, would you have Mike explain the checks and balances that we are putting in place? And I would also add that this occurred prior to my action as secretary taking the procurement from MTA and moving it to the secretary's office for oversight. And so since that has occurred, a lot of changes have been made in the procurement processes. And, of course, Mike Zimmerman has been leading an overhaul here. And I have to say that Kevin Quinn has been very diligent in chasing down these issues when they occur. This should not have happened. And we, I believe, have taken a number of steps so that things like this are far less likely.
And in the future, we can always blame it on Mark Nugent.
Exactly. Good morning, Governor. Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Mike Zimmerman, Chief Procurement Officer for the Maryland Department of Transportation. As Secretary Ron had mentioned and Administrator Quinn, we have taken a number of steps to try to educate and train the MDOT employees in contract management initiatives. We have developed a 40-hour boot camp under the new Office of Project Quality Assurance that Secretary Ron has created. that boot camp is based on a body of knowledge from professional contract management organizations such as the International Association of Contract and Commercial Management, the National Contract Management Association, the American Society for Quality, and the Institute for Supply Management. So we have taken a body of knowledge from the industry and created an MDOT-specific training boot camp. It's 40 hours. We're opening it up to the entire MDOT business units. We're in our third class right now this week. We have a class scheduled every month for the next 8 months. It is an ongoing initiative. There will likely be at least one class a month forever. And we are working with some of the TBUs to actually have TBU-specific classes outside of the monthly class to try to get the bulk of the MDOT trained in a timely fashion.
I just want to thank Mr. Zimmerman. Yeah, and the administrator and the secretary. I think it's a night and day difference. And MTA historically has had a lot of problems with procurement, and I'm very pleased to hear this because I think it will live on long after we're gone. I also like the fact that you agreed with me.
Are there any aspects of your, we've been talking for a long time about a procurement academy for all the agencies, and I hope someday we'll see it. But is there any component of what you're doing that would be useful to other agencies?
Thank you for asking. As a matter of fact, Secretary Ron
has set you up for that question.
Secretary Ron has created the MDOT University, and within MDOT University, the contract management training will be a portion of MDOT University, but we're into our third year now of our procurement university, where MDOT actually brings in MDOT employees for a period of 6 months, and they shadow our procurement officers. We have every Monday morning on-site training with one of the procurement directors, and then they go back to one of the TBUs, and they work with the procurement officer for a week. And for the rest of the week, it's a six-month program that they go through, and it's sort of in an attempt to help breed some new procurement officers for the state. We are working very closely with Bob Gleason and Mike Haefley in an attempt to help them maybe develop something for the state side.
I'm sure would agree with that. That would be tremendously useful, and there are a number of small agencies also which don't have big procurement staffs.
We actually have a couple of DOIT procurement officers in our MDOTU right now that we let them come in and sit through it.
Very good.
It can, Madam Treasurer, yes, this can be replicated, I think, by other departments, and we're happy to turn this into a profit center for MDOT.
I don't think we're going to do that.
But if it does right, it's good practice for the bottom line.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
As long as Kevin is there, can I ask a question about 10M, local transit buses?
Sure.
And it's the same question I asked earlier, only now we're talking about transit. What are we doing when we make procurements like this to achieve our emissions mandate?
So this contract this item in particular is for the purchase of medium-duty buses for our locally operated transit systems.
Right.
The MDOT MTA serves as sort of a conduit for purchasing these vehicles for the locally operated transit systems. The local systems, we do this on behalf of them, mm-hmm. and so if they make the request to us for a large procurement for electric buses for them, and
So I'm just
going to add a couple pieces to this of kind of what's going on nationwide right now with electrification. So one is there's a recognition that fleet sizes will likely need to change. So right now, MTA, for example, we've got 750 buses in our bus fleet. And when you take a look at how long you can run electric buses, for example, we run buses right now for 16, 20 hours a day. many electric buses on the market right now don't run for that long. So there's a and so as a result of that and the need to pull buses off the road, charge them, you may need to actually dramatically increase your fleet size to accommodate those buses. The second piece is the infrastructure. So just talking MDOT-MTA, we have four big bus divisions that would need electric charging stations. And so with the locally operated transit systems around the state, there's the infrastructure that's needed, not just the buses, but a tremendous amount of infrastructure. And something that states like California are talking a lot about and struggling with is redundancy. So, for example, let's say there's a security event or something very bad happens and the electric power grid goes down. And right now, our buses, for example, I know are in many of our hazard plans as ways to get people out of major cities, out of Baltimore, for example, or out of California. Those buses need to be running, and those buses need to have power going to them and need to be charged. And so it's not just the infrastructure, it's the redundancy of that infrastructure that needs to be put in as well. So while I get your point, and I totally understand and the need to drive this, there's these associated infrastructure costs that are tremendously important that have to be considered as well. Long story short, if the locally operated transit systems would like to come to us with a request for a larger, for an electric bus buy, we're open to having that conversation.
Well, I'm sure you are. Yeah. But the question is, what are we doing? Where's the leadership?
Madam Secretary, we are very active in the TCI activity that's going on right now. I know you're familiar with that. We are very active in this, and the governor has given us direction that we are to endorse and support whatever we can there. And I believe Secretary Grumbles would state as well is that we are taking a leadership role within the Northeast in this approach. So it might not be visible, but we are, and we are investing in utilizing these funds from Volkswagen to put the infrastructure out there, because it's a little chicken and egg. We're not going to have one until we have the other. And we're not, and the idea of not having infrastructure until we have enough cars and vehicles to utilize it, we're pushing forward with that infrastructure.
Well, maybe you're the. I mean, this is something the state has to do with our fleets, with local fleets. We've got to own this program, and it goes way beyond what we're talking about here. Obviously, it goes to the infrastructure, it goes to planning and zoning. It goes to this question of roads versus transit. But we have to. Someone has to be invested with the leadership. And it's not just saying, well, if the locals ask me, I'll do it, or I'll give the agencies a list of things that they can choose from, and low emissions might be among them. And that's
not. I think we're really leading the nation on these types of issues, and I'd certainly welcome your help in getting the legislature on board. I mean, the legislature
passed the bill, and I don't understand how it's going to work.
In the last legislative session, we put more money in for electric vehicle tax credits and charging stations, which they cut in half. And we did get something passed, but we've already used up for this year all of the electric vehicle tax credits that they allocated. And you talk about this infrastructure, they did not support us on the funding for putting more money into it. So we'd love to have your help.
I don't mean to be pandering, but I have to say we do have leadership on this issue, and it's the governor. The governor has been.
You can pander. I mean, we can do whatever as long as we do it. I mean, we do have goals.
Yes, let's work together on getting your colleague, your former colleagues on board.
Well, they are on board. They passed the deadline. Now the question is how you.
Well, they voted against the important legislation we needed, but cut it in half. But thank you very much.
Move approval.
Is there a second on transportation? 3-0. Last but not least, we have Department of General Services.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Nelson Reichert, Deputy Secretary of General Services. The department has 30 items on our agenda, including two supplementals. We are withdrawing items 15 CGL and 26 CGL. I'll be glad to answer any questions you have at this time.
Questions on DGS? Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second? 3-0. We are adjourned. Thank you.